right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Henrik here with Red Ice TV. Great of you to join us today. Thank you to everyone tuning in. We're having a discussion today with Richard Hauck, who returns to the show. We talked with him, I forget when it was, about a year ago, about his book, Liberalism Unmasked. Really good book, great show. Definitely check it out, guys, if you haven't seen it. But good to have you back, Richard, I should say, on the show again. So thank you for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me. I always really enjoy coming on.
Absolutely. Lots to talk about today. And I guess we could just mention briefly in the beginning, you're actually writing a follow-up to Liberalism Unmasked as well on conservatism. We don't have to go into much in detail. It's still kind of far off or whatnot, but it could be good for people to know that we don't only criticize SJWs and leftists and liberals here. We need to extend it further and talk about some of the other other kind of, people call them kosher conservatives or neocons, right? It's another whole faction, which is, I think, deserves to be criticized equally as much, to be honest.
Yeah, I have a follow-up book coming out called, like you said, Conservatism Unmasked, and it's going to look at essentially the modern conservatism movement and follow it a little bit historically, but really get into, like you said, the neoconservatism movement, the purging of former nationalists and paleoconservatives with, pushing them out of journalism. You see William Buckley with a big role in that in the National Review. You see Irving Kristol's neoconservatism movement kind of co-opting the GOP and the Republican Party in a lot of ways. I'm going to talk about those failures. I'm going to do a chapter critique of libertarianism, of what it is used for narrowly, where it can work, and the problems it has. I'll be talking quite a bit about civic nationalism, this sort of economic nationalism we see that we see a lot from, you know, Bannon was pushing it, and Trump now, we just saw him pushing it a lot in the State of the Union address, this idea that if we all make enough money, we can live peacefully in this big polyglot together. So I think it's going to be pretty good. It's going to show that the modern conservatism movement is absolutely a left-wing movement, and how that came to be. And I think it's going to also illuminate a lot of things for people. There's, especially in American politics, there's this idea that, like, the Democrats are left-wing and the Republicans are right-wing, and there's a lot of disinformation out there. I'm going to talk about Jonah Goldberg's book, Liberal Fascism, and kind of the fallacies and outright lies in there, which Dinesh D'Souza sort of kind of continued on that with his whole, right, like, the Democrats are the real KKK and Nazis, and just to give, like, a real brief explanation of that. I'm going to talk about how you can't really trace Democrat and Republican to left and right very well. You have to look at a set of elements and factors of what makes something more left or more right, and then apply really each individual policy and politician. So at the same time in the Democrat Party, you had people pushing for desegregation, pushing all kinds of civil rights legislation. And then you also had Democrats that were totally against it. And some were against it for states' rights reasons. Some were race realist. But within the Democrat Party, even if there was no Republican Party at the time, you would have still had some people more on the racial egalitarian side and other people more on kind of a hyper-nationalism, ethnic nationalism also side. So I'm going to talk about some of those characters and some of the laws that happened, who played what role in everything. And I think it's going to be really good to a really good look at American politics and get people who are kind of stuck in this, like, Democrat, Republican kind of paradigm, mm-hmm, a little bit out of it, and to see it a little more broadly. So I think it's going to be good. It's kind of a book I almost wanted to write first, before Liberalism Unmasked, because I think, like, the modern conservatism movement in a lot of ways is more damaging to our people than liberalism itself, in the sense that it kind of gives people this false sense of hope. And, you know, there's a governor in Ohio, John Kasich, who totally left-wing, but he keeps getting the most of the Ohio voters, the majority, at least enough, were Republican. And they're not like a kosher Republican. They're not like a Eisenhower Republican. These are people you talk to, and they're really generally kind of they would vote for a lot farther right person, right? But they see this guy with the R next to his name and they vote for him and they think, oh, he's better than the Democrat and he's kind of the lesser of two evils. But then this guy, you know, continuously worked to flood Ohio with a bunch of refugees and Somalis, was against gun rights every time he had a chance. He would veto bills, pro-abortion. So, you know, the people that voted for him were way further right than anything he ever governed as. But he kind of gave them the false sense of hope that he was fighting for their interest. And he never was. Totally a left-wing guy. And but because he had an R next to his name, it gives people who don't really – that kind of buy into this, Republicans are right, Democrats are left, they think he was for their interest and he wasn't. So in that sense, it's damaging because people get – they're a Republican in and then don't really pay too much attention to him anymore. Whereas if they would have just had a Democrat doing these policies, they maybe would have realized this guy's really working against them where they don't so much.
Party so politics, kind of, you know, so it's been an issue not only for America, but for many other countries, too. It's the same. And it's really the same for people who continue to work for workers' parties, right? Democratic Socialists. And they have no, like, that's their main platform, and they have no interest whatsoever in the white working classes in many Western countries anymore. So it's a rigged game, you know, and that's why we need to criticize both sides. We need to bring out when they're right, and we need to shoot them down when they're wrong. And I think in that sense, we have a better position. Those who are kind of outside, those who truly are dissidents in that sense, and anti-establishment, because we can see the system for what it is. Of course, with the rise of Trump, we saw a lot of people that were attracted to Republicanism, I guess, and the conservatives, just because there was an outsider that came in. And sure, he did reinvigorate some things into the party. He brought up talking points that were, you know, not allowed before. He broke some of the taboos in terms of the political correctness and whatnot. But now we can also begin to see, Richard, that some people are also willing to just walk with him over the cliff, and they'll support him no matter what, right? Because he's a Republican, absolutely. He's a conservative, and whatever else they see in him, right?
Yeah, you absolutely see a lot of that. And I think that's one of the big dangers, is there's people who think that because Trump's in, everything's safe, you know, and we won. And
that's it.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. People think that was the end of it. And that's kind of a real dangerous way to look at politics. And a lot of people do. And I'm hoping this kind of breaks some of that with just the way the part of the problem in the U.S. is there's only ever been like two real parties, and the parties have gone through so many iterations. There's, you know, if you look at these different political epochs and eras, there's virtually nothing in common with like a Jacksonian or a Jeffersonian Democrat to, you know, Hillary Clinton Democrat. They don't share a single thing in common, right? But, you know, you have people like Dinesh D'Souza putting out all this information and that says they are the same thing, and it confuses people, and it's harmful. But yeah, I'm going to discuss all that and get into a lot of the failures of the civic nationalism arguments, the economic nationalism. I want to talk environmentalism some more, talk the libertarians, kind of the failures of libertarianism. I want to have a little section of where I agree with liberals, but for the wrong reasons.
Right.
Just different things like that. So I think it'll be a real good follow up. And I think it'll be even more enjoyable for the people on our side, because there isn't a real good criticism out there of the conservative movement. I mean, there are good criticisms, don't get me wrong, but we have so much more literature on attacking the left and attacking Marxism and attacking, you know, critical race theory, that this is going to be kind of I'm trying to open up a little bit more of a new avenue with this.
Yeah, sounds great. Lots to look forward to that there, guys. And we'll definitely have Rich back on the show and talk about that once the book is out. Now, today we have a couple of different topics lined up. We're going to talk about the AIPAC shitstorm, sorry for the bad language, but it was brought to the surface again by Ihan Omar recently from Minnesota, Islamic, a Muslim woman. We want to kind of connect that to how the Democratic Party is really transforming and changing. And as they are turning more hard left and ultimately anti-white as well, they're also turning anti-Israel, or this new guard is bringing that with them into the picture. which poses an interesting aspect for American politics, which always, of course, traditionally have been super supportive of Israel. It's, you know, AIPAC has been there. We're going to talk a bit about that, what their role in this actually is, how powerful they are, and what's going to happen when this new guard comes in, and whether or not they're going to be able to make a dent in the influence that an organization like AIPAC really has. So that's lined up. But I thought, Rich, why don't we begin and talk about the State of the Union address and listen to a couple of outtakes quick that Trump did, because it's pertinent to what you mentioned with conservatives and this issue that is like, you know, Democrats are usually seen as the open borders party and Republicans that want to have, you know, control over immigration. They want to make sure they at least that illegal immigration is, you know, controlled and stuff like that. But in regards to what Trump mentioned in the State of the Union, it's like, what is the difference really between many of the liberal talking points and what he said? He might even go a step further when it comes to the issue of legal immigration. Let's listen to this and we can come back and talk about this.
African-American, Hispanic-American, and Asian-American unemployment have all reached their lowest levels ever recorded. I want people to come into our country in the largest numbers ever, but they have to come in legally. We must never ignore the vile poison of anti-Semitism or those who spread its venomous creed and threatens genocide against the Jewish people. With one voice, we must confront this hatred anywhere and everywhere it occurs. More than seven decades ago, he narrowly survived the Nazi concentration camps. A second Holocaust survivor, who is here tonight, was a prisoner at Dachau. Herman was one of the Americans who helped rescue Joshua from that hell on earth and defeat fascism to secure civil rights and to face down evil empires.
All right, so it's an easy, you know, point, I guess, to make, to bring up, you know, the Holocaust and say that, you know, that, you know, Holocaust bad, you know, kind of thing. But it's like, what's the relevancy of that more than just trying to score easy points, I guess, on moral issues that I would assume everyone in that chamber can could agree with in terms of like what we're given when it comes to the official history of Second World War and all that stuff. So that's like one thing. We're like, well, and he went on and on about it and Holocaust victims and, you know, kind of thing. It was quite a significant portion spent, you know, on that issue. And beyond that, of course, it was like this issue of like legal immigration that he said they want more people than ever to come in. Like, what does it matter then if it's like legal replacement versus illegal replacement, right?
Yeah, that is the difference is literally if they get their paperwork stamped off correctly or not. And it's just it's really kind of an infuriating talking point. And it would be like, you know, if they made it legal to go rape people, and you say, well, you know, I guess I don't care if my wife gets raped because it's legal now. You know, make car theft legal. Well, I guess my car got stolen. That kind of sucks. But hey, it was legal. Nothing I can do about it. And that is sort of this idea. And it's elite. It's first of all, the idea of like pop replacement migration, which is what's happening, is basically a legal fiction. It's taking the absolute dispossession and disenfranchisement of the native population and saying, well, we made it legal now, so it's okay. It's essentially, you know, the left talks a lot about social constructs. The idea of legal migration is really a social construct. It's just something made up. It's never happened in history, this type of population transfer and replacement. The only time anything like this has ever happened is during, you know, wars and invasions. And so the idea that you could take the results of a war and invasion and have it happen, and then it's okay because it's legal, that's an absolute man-made fictitious concept that should be entirely rejected by nationalists. You know, everybody, you know, the white British are a minority in much of London now. That all happened legally. There's all kinds of states in the U.S. where the majority of the population is no longer white. That happened legally. There's cities, you know, hundreds or thousands of cities and neighborhoods that are entirely non-white. That all happened legally. there's places, you know, where I walk around that I grew up that now look like, they don't look like they are. They're little Mogadishu, little Somali villages. And, you know, that happened legally.
It's horrendous. It's a crime. It's a crime. Yeah.
It is a crime. It's really not a crime.
You know, it's not this like, well, you're just sharing your country with like other people or whatever, which is like a stupid point. It's like, if you have, you know, you can have a classes and schools and neighborhoods and areas, which is like 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, that were occupied by the founding stock of the nation in question. We're talking about America, but this is true for many European countries too. And then all of a sudden you have a foreign population, a culture comes in that starts effectively occupying that area. Their kids go to the school. In some cases they built their minarets, they create their religious communities and they set everything up. It's like, that is replacement. That's taking over territory and property and things like this. And again, they might buy it legally and all that kind of stuff, but it's like, that's replacement. If it happened in any other country, which was non-white, I think a lot of liberals would be outspoken about that.
Oh, they would. They would be totally outraged about it. And I kind of saw this. There's a couple things that have been happening where close to where I live. I went and visited a friend of mine that I grew up with this past winter, right before Christmas. And when I was a kid, I used to spend a lot of time over in this neighborhood. And this wasn't really all that long ago. I mean, we're talking maybe 15 years ago, even 10 years ago. 10 years ago is a lot different. And like every house in this neighborhood used to be decorated for Christmas. There used to be lights everywhere. And a bunch of blacks and Indians started moving in over the last 10 years. And when I went over this time, his house and one other house in this neighborhood were decorated for Christmas. And it's because all these people, they don't celebrate Christmas. And they all came legally and they bought these houses legally, I guess, probably a lot of it with like government money.
Yeah.
That we pay for, but notwithstanding, they had their paperwork filled out. So in this technical sense, they were legal, and that there's a total loss of social capital. My friend doesn't know any of his neighbors anymore, and he used to know all of them. I mean, these are people we grew up with, and most of them, he's one of the last to have moved out. Most of the people have moved away to a more wider area. You know, you don't see Christmas lights anymore. It's totally killing the culture. This place I used to really enjoy as a kid is essentially gone now.
Yeah.
And that happened legally. And that's the kind of thing that we talk about that a lot of people don't really seem to get.
Conservatives, they just like, it's so safe to harp on illegal immigration, but it's like, what's the difference at the end of the day, right? It's, as you said, it's like, yeah, you might have your paperwork in order, but same results at the end of it.
It's absolutely the same results. And another thing that's kind of maddening about these conservatives, either the same people who say I want legal migration or the same people that say there's a war on Christmas and they're changing our culture, yeah, and I don't want to be Islamified. Well, yeah, that happened in this little white neighborhood in Ohio.
Yeah.
It's totally, there's no, you wouldn't even know it was Christmas hardly if you're going there. So these things that they say are totally incompatible. Their idea of keeping of being pro-constitution, of being pro-Christian, of being pro-American culture is entirely incompatible with the idea of legal non-white migration. And it's crazy. I mean, we're going to be a minority in the country, and it happened legally. And that we have to pay for it.
Great,
it's
huh?
Crazy.
Yep, it's nuts. It's definitely crazy. And it would never happen anywhere else, I think, than in the West. So we have Trump and we have the things that he's bringing, that he brought to the table, which was good for a while, and he managed to push the envelope, as I said, on some, you know, political correct issues and whatnot. But there seems to have been a total surrender. And of course, more recently here, we can bring up the article. We did have the Trump that intends to sign off on the border deal to avoid another shutdown. In other words, there's no fighting spirit there. There's no desire to stand his ground and say, you know what, fine, let's do another shutdown then, if that's what you guys want. Like, I want the wall. That's what I ran on. That's what people voted for. But no, he just says, well, Trump said Tuesday he was not happy with the tentative deal reached by congressional negotiators late Monday night that falls short of his original demands, right? So they think they've allocated $1.6 billion. To basically repair like the fence. No, sorry, I was wrong. It was $1.375 billion for a border barrier and he wanted $5.7 billion. So the wall is not happening. This is not a surprise, of course, to many who have been saying this now, but it's a nail in that coffin. I mean, it's not going to happen at this point.
Yeah, it doesn't look like it, and it's that money's a drop in the bucket. You know, the annual military budget's like, what, $600 billion, something like that? It's just tremendous, and, you know, there's this trope. I just saw Rand Paul talk about how America is the world's police, and that's not really true at all. We spend all this money, but, you know, there's all kinds of European countries being invaded by all these hordes, and we don't protect them. We don't police them. We're not doing anything to protect pollution and environment in all these third world countries. We're not the world's police. We're really Israel's police in the Middle East. And that's the reality of it. It would be, I would not even be entirely against being the world's police if we were helping protect Europe from African and Arab invaders and things of that nation, but or protecting protecting wildlife and old growth forests. But we're not doing that. We're just protecting Israel and Israel's interest. But that amount of money, I mean, you could just deploy the Marines and have the Army Corps of Engineers. I wrote an article a year and a half or so ago for Occidental Observer about the plan and the money and how it would work. And I think part of the problem is that Trump isn't a lawyer and he's not legally savvy and doesn't know his way around the legal system. And he doesn't have any nationalist lawyers that are really in his corner. He didn't know any. He basically brought these people who were good at real estate and finance deals and surrounded himself with those people. And I think he genuinely is afraid of impeachment proceedings because it gets talked about so much constantly by the left. And he knows he doesn't have too much support that would fight for him. And I think it's kind of sad because I think his heart was in the right place on a lot of stuff. And he just didn't surround himself with the people who know how to get it done. And he's afraid. I think he's afraid to make any real moves on his own because they had this impeachment thing over his head constantly. You know, he could just use, like I said, he could use the military and Army Corps of Engineers to do it. And I saw that the Beto O'Rourke was just saying we shouldn't use eminent domain, the Fifth Amendment takings clause to take people's farms and land for the wall. Like, that's just such a stupid excuse. You could just make the wall 1 foot on the side of Mexico from the U.S. border, mm-hmm. and you wouldn't even have to worry about it.
Of course.
You could get an easement. I mean, electric companies get easements for more land than what the wall would be. And so that's just a total, like, non-argument. And this is the same kind of this Beto guy and people like him that say we can't afford the wall and it's a waste of money. These are the people that are OK spending, it's, you know, mass migration in the U.S. costs over $300 billion a year to taxpayers, legal and illegal. So, you know, we have money for that. They have money. They're OK taxing the middle class personal income taxes to give welfare to all these people, but they can't, you know, they think getting an easement on some people's lands who live in the middle of nowhere along the border is really a big deal. It's just crazy to me.
No, it's just, it's just excuses, nuts. You know, and I can't find the article now, but I got two that are somewhat similar to it. But I remember this was about a year ago, maybe, where America was getting involved. It bothers me that I can't find it right now, but it was talking about how America has to protect, helping to protect European countries, right? And they don't. They have, of course, NATO has a strong presence. They have bases in many European countries, especially when it comes to aiming their missiles against Russia and stuff like that, and, you know, taking over, gobbling up satellite states to Russia, to the former Soviet Union and stuff like that. But they were talking about how America is going to start policing and protecting Jewish communities in European countries, that it was this big program running that we need to do more and America needs to, you know, both funding and security and all these things needed to go to the Jewish communities in Europe, you know, which is just like interesting way to juxtapose it when they're like, they show no interest at all in like preserving Western values, but they're more interested in ensuring that you know, Israel and the Jewish communities are safe. It's just like a standard default position by America. It's like they're more interested in protecting them than even their own the founding stock or those that were related to them that came from Europe. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really sickening. And that kind of is a good segue, I guess, to go into the AIPAC stuff too.
Yeah.
I think there was that bill called the American Envoy of countering anti-Semitism or something like that.
Maybe that's the one I'm thinking of, yeah. And
I think that's the one you're thinking of from the last congressional season, and it was basically giving tax money, American tax money, to the State Department to monitor global anti-Semitism. And there was just something that just happened today, came across my feed. There was on the Congress floor, there was a joint resolution about removing troops from Yemen. And a Jewish congressman, David Kustoff, said, wanted to add an amendment to this. This is just today. And he said, it is in the national security interest of the United States to combat anti-Semitism around the world. And he went on this 5-minute speech about the Tree of Life Synagogue, rising anti-Semitism feelings in Europe, and how he wanted to add to this joint resolution that had nothing to do with anti-Semitism. It was just pulling troops out of Yemen. Mm-hmm. Wanted to make sure that Jews were protected. And then, so he's a Republican. This kind of goes into the conservatism Unmasked talked about, how it's exactly two sides of the same coin, and that the whole, if you talk about, if the left-right spectrum is this big, the difference between Democrats and Republicans is, you know, maybe this, if that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Elliot Engel, a New York Jewish House member, said, I rise in support of this resolution. We need not tolerate anti-Semitism in any shape or form. And the motion was adopted 424-0. So no opposition to add this, you know, discussion about how much we need to protect Jews. And this is all done. These people are being paid by, you know, U.S. citizens. They don't get voted in to protect Jews in Israel, but that's the effect of it.
And let's just define, before you go on there, let's just define as well how they define anti-Semitism, because weaved into this, as usual, same thing with hate speech and things like this, are very dangerous, you know, political limiting capabilities for people to express criticism towards, for example, Israel, right? And valid criticism that they're basically, and they're doing this with the anti-BDS law too, right? They're outlawing the capability for individuals and even organizations and companies at the end of it to make the choices that they want to make, even if that includes not working together with Israel. But in this, the State Department defining anti-Semitism, they even have like such outrageous things as saying, to point out double standards, for example, is like anti-Semitism. And this is considering like, this is a crime, right? This is actually going to be punishable by law. Yeah, drawing comparisons of contemporary Israeli policy to that of Nazis, using the symbols and images associated with classic anti-Semitism. Even if you make a joke, that could be a, you know, if you use the Happy Merchant as a joke, like, come on, there's like plenty of people that make fun of whites all the time and rednecks, and they draw cartoons and everything. This is ridiculous. You could actually be criminally charged, right? Yeah, applying double standards by requiring of it a behavior not expected or demanded of any other democratic nation. Anyway, it goes on from there, but it's just like this truly Orwellian, dangerous things that are weaved into this thing as well, these new bills that are coming in. Basically, where they're trying to shield themselves from any level of criticism. It's just outrageous to me.
It is. It is outrageous. And there was a Trump speech even before the State of the Union where he talked about the vicious poison of anti-Semitism has to be like stomped out or something of that nature.
Yep.
And it was very Orwellian, and it was very reminiscent of some of the early Soviet laws after the Bolsheviks took over, where anti-Semitism was punishable by death. And it was very similar language. And you see kind of the same things if you read any of the dissident literature coming out of Russia, Romania, any of these Eastern Bloc nations that were under the control of Jewish communism. I have a section here I found. This is actually from my book, Liberalism Unmasked. And I talked about this like concept of election meddling with the whole Russophobia thing. And I'm just going to read an excerpt of it to maybe help explain why you see these combating anti-Semitism convoys and these joint House resolutions condemning anti-Semitism and praise for Israel. So here's the section. The Jewish Telegraph Agency reports the top five campaign donors to Clinton's presidential run were Jewish. The Jerusalem Post reports that 50% of the donations to the Democratic Party and 25% of the donations to the Republican Party were contributed by Jewish donors. and reports that 75% of Jewish donors or Jewish voters supported Clinton, and further notes that the degree to which liberalism and liberal ideas has been good for the Jews in America helps explain why so many American Jews think liberalism and Judaism are one and the same. Same thing happened during the Obama years. According to the Times of Israel, all the top donors to Obama were Jewish. The New York Times recently discussed a shift in the funding of pro-Israeli donors from the DNC to the Republican Party, and the influx of millions of dollars in donations to support Israel and Jewish causes had led the Republican Party to accept, quote, little dissent on the topic of Israel. So those are all from the Jewish Telegraph Agency, the Jerusalem Post, the Times of Israel, and the New York Times is where that my sources on that information is from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you have in Jewish articles, in Jewish publications, you have them kind of bragging about the patting themselves on the back, bragging, whatever, about the immense support that they give to both sides of the political aisle in the United States.
Yep.
So then when you see this kind of stuff about the absolute devotion to Israel and to Jewish causes, you know, you can't help but think, you know, this money and AIPAC that helps get donors in connection with people running for Congress has a lot to do with it. And that's what Ilhan Omar said that got her this, you know, big backlash. She didn't even go into that level of analysis.
No,
she just
no.
had this idea, this correct idea that that AIPAC has some, you know,
influence. Yeah, they have power. Yeah. They have influence, and they're using that. And just to underline that point, let's see, even here's like three really short videos I took from their own YouTube channel. You talked about bipartisanism. In other words, no matter who's in power, they still have this influence, right? Let's take a look at this. It's a little bit over a minute long.
Politics in America is contentious. In fact, by some measures, Democrats and Republicans are more divided today than at any other time in the last two decades. But America's support for Israel transcends partisan politics. So when it comes to strengthening America's relationship with Israel, support must come from both sides of the aisle. That's where AIPAC comes in. For decades, AIPAC has worked to strengthen, protect, and promote the U.S.-Israel alliance by encouraging bipartisan support in Congress. Bipartisanship is more than just a nice idea. It's the most effective way to build a lasting consensus to support Israel. There are two practical reasons why. First, a partisan approach will ultimately fail when the opposing party inevitably comes into power. Bipartisanship is the only way to affect policies that keep Israel safe, no matter which party is in control. Second, consider the math. While most bills require a simple majority to pass, in the Senate, each senator has the right to filibuster or block a bill's consideration. To overcome that opposition, a bill needs the support of 3/5 of the Senate, which one party rarely holds. Therefore, as the years go by, a consistently pro-Israel Congress requires the support of both parties through a bipartisan approach. Please join AIPAC in working to ensure that America continues to stand with Israel through strong, bipartisan support in Congress.
Right, so there you go, folks. It's not a secret, right? They pride themselves on this. This is how they run the show, if you will. It's like no matter who's in power, we're always there. We can, you know, we have the Senate, we have the Congress, we have, you know, it's always going to be pro-Israel. So now when you have a couple of voices that's come in, and it is interesting, you mentioned this before we went live too, that it comes from voices that, of course, have in many regards been enabled by, maybe not AIPAC, but in many regards, the individuals that are supportive of the AIPAC and work for them or part of their organization are part of other organizations that also kind of lobby for the importation of these individuals, right? They come from Muslim countries in many regards. Same thing when they talk about anti-Semitism in Europe. It's not white Westerners. It's like, you know, it's Muslims in many regards that have been imported by organizations like Paideia, which Barbara Spector headed up for a while. You have HIAS, of course, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society and things like this. So it's an interesting dynamic of what's happening here now as the Democrats are turning more, you know, kind of hard left, ultimately enabled by the policies of many very fiercely pro-Jewish organizations, right?
Yeah, that is interesting. What they're kind of losing, I don't want to say losing control of it, but it's getting a little turbulent for them in some ways, where you have Hebrew Immigration Aid Society that was massively influential, the American Jewish Committee, American Jewish Congress. There was an American, some American committee of Eastern European Jews that were all very influential to helping get the 65 Immigration Act passed that Jewish Congressman Emanuel Seller introduced. And what that did is opened up, you know, migration from a quota system that was a system from the 20s that was influenced by people like Madison Grant, who were racialists that wanted to keep the America of European stock. So it changed all that and enabled people from Africa, from the Arab world, and Jews to come into the U.S. And so a lot of these people are here because of Jewish policies like that. And then now you see they criticize Israel in some level, where it's, like you said, they're kind of taking a more true left instead of a J left turn, whereas they are genuinely against any sort of ethno-nationalism or self-determination. They want all the borders to come down, and they see Israel as sort of this rogue nationalist state that is, they call it, you know, an apartheid state of how they treat the Palestinians and their neighbors and things of that nature. So they do clash on that topic. There's some interesting works. The one book, Semitism, Being Jewish in the Age of Trump, it opens by basically saying Jews flourish when walls come down, and that they are not a insular and separate minority group, that they're just one of many groups within a nation. And there's a piece by Arthur Astor that says this, something similar, that he's addressing European anti-Semitism versus Muslim anti-Semitism, and he basically says throughout the history the Jews feared the white Europeans way more than they ever feared any feared like Muslims, and they had a much, I guess, cozier relationship with Muslims throughout history. And you see this play out in some ways, despite the differences that they might have in Middle Eastern politics, that are regional and territorial based. You see, you know, Jews helping Muslims come into Spain. You see things like I said in the 65 Immigration Act going on. And you have there's interesting cozy relationships throughout history. There's an article I cite in my book that is from an academic history journal, and it basically talks about the slave trade of white Europeans, particularly Poles, that went on a lot during the Ottoman Empire. But there was a tremendous amount of Jewish slave traders that were selling to the Muslims during the Ottoman Empire. And so you see throughout history that these two groups have often worked together to kind of undermine European society.
It's just a historical fact, you know, for people who, it is, you know, dispute that or whatever. It's just a fact that we've seen those links in the past. There are also some rabbis, they talk openly about the fact that there's tied to actually messianic prophecy, that when the white Europeans mix with like the Arab population, that will pave way for the Messiah and things like that. It's very kind of weird religious ideas. Even just the idea of controlling or that the Jews can put themselves in a position where they're very influential and things like that is also something that's going to be aiding them to have the ascent of the Messiah. And this is, of course, religious ideas as well, kind of on top. But it's not only an ethnic supremacist idea, it's like a religious idea.
Yeah, there is the sect of where the religiosity kind of intersects of with Muslims and Jews, and then like you said, there's the even of the more atheistic diaspora population. They, you know, and the writings are all over. You know, you see it time and time again where they say they'd rather have Muslims, they'd rather live among Muslims and kind of be a plurality than be a Jewish minority in a majority white state. And that's I'm working on an article about Jews in mass migration, and that those are some of the things they talk about. But yeah, insofar as the AIPAC stuff, man, you know, all Omar did was make comments that were had a slightly negative connotation that other people like Joe Biden has made. Joe Biden made did gave a speech, talked about a lot about the influence of Judaism on the United States. And there's this article by Jennifer Epstein, and quoting Joe Biden, says the truth is that Jewish heritage, Jewish culture, Jewish values are such an essential part of who we are that it's fair to say that Jewish heritage is American heritage. The Jewish people have contributed greatly to America. No group has such an outsized influence per capita as all of you standing of all of you standing before you and all of those who went before me and all those who went before you. So he's talking about the influence that Jews have on politics. And I think I forget the number, but there's several thousand Jewish organizations. I think there's more Jewish organizations per like any per capita of any other ethnic group in the country. He talks. Joe Biden went on to talk about how the embrace of immigration was part of the Jewish contribution to social justice movements in America. He says you can't talk about the civil rights movement without talking about the freedom riders like Jack Greenberg. I just worked on a piece about Martin Luther King on Martin Luther King Day that talked about how the majority of the, you know, quote unquote white people that were marching with Martin Luther King in Selma were Jewish students. He goes on to talk about shows like Biden then goes on to talk about shows like Will and Grace in the media, talks about Bob Dylan, Gershwin, Einstein, talks about American jurisprudence. So some Supreme Court justices, Brandeis, Fortas, Frankfurter, Cardozo, Ginsburg, Breyer, Kaden. If you or I, Henrik, went on and said, hey, you know, there's a really weird disproportionate rate of Jews in Congress and the Supreme Court, we would get called anti-Semites. But if you are praising it and you were saying, wow, this is great, you know, it's all okay. So there's this whole article about everything we said, mass migration, Civil Rights Act, integration, disproportionate influence on American politics. Joe Biden saying all these things that if they come from a nationalist are considered anti-Semitic tropes. You know, there was just an article that came out that said about the overrepresentation. I think Congress is 6% Jewish and they make up 2% of the people. So they have the Congress has, you know, a huge overrepresentation, 300% overrepresentation than what you would think they would have if it was just based on population. Here's an article from Forward. It says Jewish groups get 95% of Homeland Security grants. So all of the grants that go to private organizations for security, most of those go to Jewish organizations, like I believe like schools and synagogues and different things like that. So you see this, you know, very, very well documented everywhere. But if somebody who is saying it is as a criticism, you know, they have everybody come down on them and pass these, you know, kind of want to kick them out. There's people that want to strip Omar of like her Senate committees or whatever one she on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's wild.
Yeah, exactly. It's depending on who says it. It's not about the message. It's about the messenger and their intention, yeah. Right? So as you say, if you praise it, it's true and it's happening. If you criticize it, it's shut down as a crazy conspiracy theory. And of course, this can't stand in terms of logic and, you know, just observing and reflecting on reality, right? So even to a certain extent, the not this one, but the definition, it's interesting, too, that they had on the State Department, that try to replace, if we just replace the word Jews with white, or let's say Europeans, right? Just think of a couple of these, because this is what they're trying to outlaw. Think of whether it's okay to have laws that are passed against this if it was concerning white people, right? So it says Europhobia is a certain perception of Europeans which may be expressed as hatred towards Europeans. Rhetorically and physical manifestations of Europhobia are directed towards Europeans and non-European individuals and or their property towards European community institutions and religious facilities. So it says Europhobia is frequently charges Europeans with conspiring to harm humanity. And it's often used to blame Europeans for why things go so wrong. It is expressed in speech, writing, visual forms and actions, blah, blah, blah. Calling for, aiding or justifying the killing or harming of Europeans in the name of radical ideology or of an extremist view of religion. Making mendacious, dehumanizing, demonizing or stereotypical allegations about Europeans, such as the power of Europeans as a collective, such as, especially but not exclusively, the myth about a world European conspiracy or like a colonial conspiracy. Of the Europeans controlling media, economy, government, etc., accusing Europeans as a people of being responsible for real or imagined wrongdoings, accusing Europeans as a people or Europe as a set of countries of inventing or exaggerating, the crimes against us. This could go on and on. You can just read the definition of it, and if you would replace Europeans or white people with the word Jews here, you would see that it's like, oh, okay, but that's actually happening, like, in media, like, all the time. They blame white people collectively for slavery. We're behind, not only white supremacy, but we're, like, making the world more unequal. And it just goes on, the levels of criticism that's aimed against whites and Europeans. In that case, it gets a pass. But now they're trying to pass laws that basically is going to outlaw any kind of criticism of Israel, or the fact that if there are individuals or organizations that do hold power and influence politically, NGOs or what have you, then they can wrap that in under the umbrella of anti-Semitism and actually outlaw the criticism of them. Very dangerous.
It is. It is very dangerous. And what you were reading, you're replacing it if it was European. That's how a European-founded country should be.
Exactly.
The law should be. The government should be protecting European people that founded the country. And I was, after Steve King came out and said, made some comments about white nationalism, they passed that, basically this, just a condemnation of him. And I think everybody but one person voted for it in Congress. And the one, it was a black congressman who said he didn't support it because it wasn't like harsh enough and not punishing enough of Steve King. And all he was basically saying is, what's so wrong with white nationalism? When did this become such like a nasty word? And I found that very interesting, the racial aspect of it, because, you see these, I'm looking at this article in the Times of Israel that says, Senate unanimously passes bill marking 50 years since Jerusalem reunification, and how the 90-0 vote on Capitol Hill says Jerusalem should remain the undivided capital of Israel. And then it has a picture of Trump and a yarmulke, Schumer and McConnell here together, because it's a bipartisan thing, of course. And what I'm going with this is, and what I find interesting and disturbing is that it's not that nationalism is condemned. What people is what I think I want to express to people, it's that white nationalism is being condemned. And it's not that these people condemn identity politics at all.
No,
they only condemn white identity politics. If you're a Jewish nationalist that is a Zionist, that's totally fine. According to this, 100% of our elected officials are Jewish nationalists, and maybe even frame it as Jewish supremacists. Mm. When there are these groups like La Raza, Black Lives Matter, groups within Congress, like the Congressional Black Caucus, the Hispanics have something similar, I believe. And then you see on the floor of Congress, like I mentioned with that joint resolution earlier today, where you have Jewish Congress people taking up time to talk about anti-Semitism. These are all expressions of identity politics and racial nationalism. And those are all fine, and they are seen as good and something that should be continued. And so this is very – a lot of people that I've talked to that are maybe a little bit more – I don't want to say normies, but I guess normies in a way, or maybe just not as far along, they will say things like, well, this is just a condemnation of nationalism and identity politics. But people need to understand it's absolutely not at all. All these people, including the Republicans, love nationalism and they love identity politics. they trot out their base blacks. You know, Trump did it at the State of the Union speech that you played when he's going on and on about Asian, Hispanic, and black unemployment. He didn't say anything about whites, the one group that got him elected. He would have never got elected just with those groups because they hardly voted for him. And even after the pandering in the midterm, all the pandering that went on, then they had the midterms and it didn't, you know, didn't do any good. Never even mentioned white people. It's like they don't exist.
Yeah. So it's a third rail almost of trying to make it, if you're supportive of it, you know, it's like, don't bring it up.
Yeah. So not only is white nationalism and white identity politics totally condemned while they support all other brands of identity politics and nationalism, you can't even say, hey, I did some good stuff for the white community too. It's totally, politicians aren't even allowed to say that they are helping the people that got them elected.
It's almost like if they would have said, my administration did things that stopped like gentrification or, you know, stuff like that, then it would be praised, right? Like we did things that prevented whites from getting ahead,
Yeah, that's exactly right.
It's bizarre, you know.
And I think the Ilhan Omar and Steve King recent two kind of debacles in Congress really highlight that this isn't really an issue of nationalism, because all Omar did was start to nip at the very edge of Jewish nationalism. She didn't even say Israel should be destroyed or anything that maybe somebody from the Palestinian Liberation Organization might have said. It was very mild. And for that, you know, she had to issue an apology and all this stuff. And then, like I said, you contrast that with Steve King. He didn't even come out and support white nationalism or nationalists.
That was just a fraud. It needs to be pointed out. It was a piece by the New York Times. We broke it down in one of our Weekend Warrior shows. He issued on his Twitter what he actually said. And it was basically the New York Times jumbling two things together. It was clear that he was like reframing his wording. And it was thinking about, you know, he was talking about, oh, they all call us racist and white nationalist and things like this. And then he's like rethinking. And it's like, Western civilization, how does that even became a bad word, right? And they just took out that pause and said, he said, fascism, racism, white nationalism, white supremacy, how did that become a bad word? That's basically what they did. It was fake news. It was a fraud.
Right. It was. And even, I mean, I guess even if you do take it as it being him saying what's wrong with white nationalism, even then wouldn't be, I mean, a problem. But yeah, they did.
No, I agree. But you know what I'm saying? It's like he was cucking like still and it doesn't matter, you know, it's like he doesn't help.
That's a great point. Yeah. Great point. He was still he was not being our guy. He was still being a cuck.
Yeah. Now look at what it got him. Right? This,
yeah, exactly. There was a Washington Post piece that I have a friend from law school that I had a couple beers with, and he was trying to say like the idea you should go after this abstract idea of Western civilization and not make it racial, so you don't like get bogged down in white supremacy or something. But you know, and this was a little while ago before the Steve King stuff. I said that's not going to work because they're going to say Western civilization is racist too.
Yeah, it's white supremacy.
Right, exactly. And right after that Steve King thing came out, Washington Post published an article that says Steve King says he was just defending Western civilization.
That's a problem too. Yep, I saw that one. Yeah. It's amazing.
So even if you go the paleo conservative, like American nationalist, Western chauvinism route, it doesn't do you any good. So you might as well just be a white nationalist because you get attacked. You don't get attacked because you're a member of Western civilization as a brown person, right? You get attacked specifically because you're white, not because some people, there are these like boomer types that say, oh, they're attacking us because of our values and the Constitution. They don't care about the Constitution more than the fact that it's a proxy for white views and white beliefs, that it was a document written by white men to govern white men. They don't really, really honestly care about the structure of the republic what rights are guaranteed, and these people kind of pretend that they do, and it's not, they don't even get that far. It's a total racial aspect of it.
That's why the left gets more things right on that regard than the right conservatives does, right? Because they keep denying things that the left actually accurately identifies and says like, well, actually, you know, talking about like achievements of Western civilization, there's like the conservatives say, well, it's not about race. It's not about race. And the left is like, yeah, yeah, it is. And we're like, yeah, actually it is. Right? Because yeah, it's like, those things, I think, is a reflection of the ethnic properties of Europeans, for example, right? And we're all different. We have other, you know, there's different aspects and all that kind of stuff. But it's like, we're not allowed to say that, like, we've done good stuff and we're proud of that and we're not going to back down. Like, that is the crime. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And that's a good point you bring up. And it's kind of one of those places I also agree with the left for the wrong reasons. The left always calls, like, people who don't want Muslims in the U.S. or Europe racist. And then the conservatives will say, well, it's not about race. It's about religion. I don't like them because they're Muslim, not the color of the skin. But really, Islam is just a proxy for Arab people. If all the Muslims were white, they probably wouldn't really care. And the left accurately gets that. And they also accurately understand that most people who oppose Islam don't really delve into Islam. They don't know much about Islam or what's it about. They know it as this abstract, like, desert religion, but they don't really have any concrete, reasons to dislike Islam itself outside of the fact that either they're not Christian, which is a proxy for white in the West, and that they're Arab people. And so the left, that's another place that they kind of accurately say, well, you're actually, when you say you don't want Muslims here, you're actually saying you don't want Arabs here. And that's the truth, because yeah. If all the Arabs converted tomorrow to Christianity or were atheist, we still wouldn't want them here.
No.
And the conservatives would still have to come up with some other, like, explanation. But the truth is, if everybody in Somalia was Christian, I still don't want them here. You know, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, they're not honest and genuine, and that's why they keep losing as well. That's why they keep losing ground. It doesn't make sense. They can't take a stand. They don't put their foot down. It's not. And then you realize on some level too that they're not meant to, right? The GOP's strategy of kind of being controlled by the neocon movement behind the scenes, you realize that there's much more going on to it than that. And I want to pick up and talk about this more in the second part. We're going to take a break here. We're running a little bit over, but it's all good. It's very interesting, this discussion, and talking about, you know, as I said, the articles about what happened to Ilhan Omar and many others as well. There's many other people that have come out, but we're talking about this issue that there's a new creed, new version or new leadership within the Democratic Party that's rising up. They call them the House Freshmen, right, on Fox here. From Omar to Ocasio-Cortez, and we're going to talk about her too and her new Green Deal a little bit later too. But something is changing, right? It's transforming the Democratic Party. And so what do they need to do? How is this going to be? How's this going to pan out in the future? Is if these new breeds of Democrats get in, are they actually going to be able to make a dent on organizations like AIPAC? Or are they going to just fall back and kind of learn who's in charge at the end of it? So that's some of the questions we're going to get into in part two. Richard, why don't you just briefly plug Liberalism Unmasked, your book, which we talked about in detail last time you were on. People can, of course, go and check out that show in full. For all the details about the book, but that's what you have. They can follow you on Twitter. Let them know too if there's any other way that they can where they can find your work.
Sure. The book is Liberalism Unmasked, and it's a pretty interesting work, and it's very comprehensive, and I try to make it almost encyclopedic. It has over 600 citations, so everything I say in there, you can go look right to the footnote and pull up the article, and I've everything that's either online I've put in an archive to, or have the DOI number where you can find it easily. I talk about, I kind of do two different things in it. One, I go through dozens and dozens of liberal arguments. They're everything from gun control myths, talk a little bit about the history of gun control in the US, a bunch of stats. There's some interesting things like the most counties in the US have zero murders per year. They're highly concentrated in areas that are more non-white. You see a racial breakdown of gun crime in the book. I talk about things like the idea that black people get arrested for drug crimes, even though they use at the same rate. I kind of put that in perspective in the rates of women using versus incarceration rates, and then talk about the fact that even though the self-reported rates of drug use are the same, that's actually a lie. And I cite two studies, one that asked people what, you know, it broke it down by race, and I asked them, when's, do you use drugs? And what they found is that black men were about 6 times more likely to say, no, they don't use drugs. And then on a urine analysis, turns out they were using drugs. And there's also a study I put in about the rate of people by race going into emergency rooms for drug overdose, and the rate for black men was much, much higher. So, you know, any kind of myth, whether it's the wage gap, the mass shootings in the US versus Europe that you heard Obama talk about a lot, different climate change things, I go all through all that. And then I also do a pretty thorough critique of the behavior and mindset of liberals and how they operate, some of the failures of their cognitive functioning, and, you know, the things like their constant cognitive dissonance and how they remedy that and how it plays out, the misinformation that is spread constantly and how they use redefinitions of words to fit their political narrative. One example I talk about racism, how at one point racism used to be this idea that you had a irrational dislike of another race with no experience or knowledge, right? And so with that definition, if you said, I dislike a certain race, and without any reason, they would call you a racist. Okay. But if you said, I dislike a certain race because they use more welfare, they commit more crime, they destroy social capital, and I don't like this aspect of their culture. Now, according to the old definition that used to be around like in the 70s or maybe even later than that, they would say, okay, well, it's not an irrational like dislike of this other group. You now have a reasoned and kind of thoughtful explanation. So you're not a racist. You're just you'd be a race realist, you know? But now they've redefined it to any negative criticism, anything you say about a race that is not glowingly positive, anything negative, or just now you can basically be racist just by being white and kind of being out and about in society, where because of power and what they consider to be unearned privilege and power that they mostly exaggerate, just by existing, your existence is oppressive in racism to non-whites. And so I kind of talk about how that changed and how they manipulate language to kind of, you know, get across the narrative or kind of get their claws in things. And it's just always amorphous, whatever their talking points are.
And they claim we hold the power and kind of thing. And that's wrong. Right. But it's like, but all of it is about an effort to them trying to grab that power and for themselves, right, and to them for hold on to it. So it's not the act that's wrong. It's just that they are not the ones who hold it, you know?
Yeah, and that I touch on that a bit about like the Antifa and how they claim they're against authoritarianism and fascism, but they are just left-wing authoritarians. And it's not that they have any issue. If Antifa doesn't have any issue whatsoever with authoritarianism from their inception of the communist, like of being the paramilitary wing in the Communist Party of Deutschland, they were always an authoritarian group. Communists are de facto authoritarian. It's what they do. It's how they implement their government, right? So these people that claim to be anti-authoritarian are only really truly anti-authoritarian if you're on the right wing. They love left-wing authoritarianism. And, you know, I talk a lot about that. And there's just a lot of good little tidbits in there. Like that, for example, talking about how Antifa is left-wing authoritarian and they started out from the Communist Party of Deutschland. And there's like all this going around how Antifa are the real fascists. And I talk about they're, of course, communists. They're not fascists. There's a difference. And I think even if you're real familiar with this stuff, there's going to be a lot of things you didn't know about. And it's also good for people who are a little bit more normies, I think, because it starts out and brings people up to speed of how we got to this definition of liberalism from classical liberalism and how kind of the Wilson era and then the FDR kind of started playing with the terms liberal and progressive and changed the meaning from negative rights to positive rights. So it gives you a good basis. If you don't have that, or for people who don't have it. And even if you do, I talk a lot about, you know, all kinds of different influence, who passed different laws in the U.S., how they came about. I talk about kind of everything from the income tax to Common Core is in there. So there's really a little bit for everybody.
Awesome.
And so the other, you can find that on Amazon or Art Coast or Barnes & Noble. And I'm on Twitter at HeyWildRich. And have some articles over at the Occidental Observer and Countercurrents as well, is where I publish some different pieces on, you know, I had one on Martin Luther King Day. I've talked about one of the really popular ones on Countercurrents was about, if you've ever been interested in seeing all the race mixing ads and advertising where it's always a white woman with a black guy, I do a pretty thorough two-part discussion of that, of kind of who is behind these advertising agencies, what the outcomes of, there's a big section of the outcomes of race mixed couples, and it's very negative. And that there's a big discussion of that there. And some, there's the Sky King one, some cultural stuff. Talk about the Eric Klopper article about he does a presentation, a 2-hour long presentation that got him fired. He's actually a Jewish guy who's adamantly against circumcision, and he got fired from his job at Harvard, I believe, for this presentation, basically for anti-Semitism. And it was just all well-cited facts, and they got rid of him anyway.
Yep.
So any kind of current stuff, some cultural stuff, I encourage you to check it out. A little bit of everything there.
Yeah, definitely. We'll have some links up to that, some great content there for people to check out. Of course, the book as well, all the links in the description, and make sure you follow Rich on Twitter as well. But yeah, we'll take a short break here, guys. We'll be back at redicemembers.com, part 2. Check it out, support us, and support the work of people like Rich so we can continue. We'll see you on the other side of this break.